Well, now, today, the Dalajay government is independent of communists and socialists, but it's supported still by the radical socialists. But it would have a very slim majority if the socialists voted against it. Dalajay was definitely weakened by the Munich surrender. He has issued decree laws, which, on the whole, seem to be fair enough, but which the workers feel will abrogate their 40-hour week. And they struggled for a long time to get that, and they're not going to give it up very easily. Now, of course, Dalajay points out that he's only asking them to abandon it in the national defense industries, and that they're to be paid for overtime, and that overtime is to be continued and to be carried out only where national necessity demands. But the communists, who are the chief troublemakers, insist that Dalajay has sold out to the industrialists and that he's trying to take away from the workers what they won with so much difficulty through the Popular Front. Well, the communists represent 1 million votes and 60 deputies. Now there's a threat that their party may be dissolved. I doubt that Dalajay will do that. It seems to me that the chances are that the French workers between now and Wednesday will think things over, and that in the face of the obvious threat that they have from the fascist states, that they will decide that for the time being they can afford to give up the advantage of the 40-hour week for the sake of peace and orderly government in France. Dalajay is following a precedent set by Aristide Briand in 1910. And in the north of France, the move has succeeded against the miners. That's why I'm inclined to believe it will succeed against the other workers who have declared their intention to go out on a general strike in Wednesday. But the Dalajay cabinet is weakening, and it's a question whether or not there will be general elections following a resignation of the Dalajay cabinet. Those general elections, by the way, are much more apt to shift to the right than they are to the left. There have been important new developments in the United States foreign and defense policy in the New World. There is an unprecedented expansion of both the Army and the Navy. And tonight, you heard the news that Secretary of War Woodring is calling for a development of Panama Canal defenses. Just what are we preparing for? That's not quite clear. Those of you who listen to the People's Platform discussion on that subject will realize what a difference of opinion there is. The President of the United States has indicated that we must be prepared to defend the Western Hemisphere against attack from east or west. And, of course, for the first time, we have a definite program for closer economic, cultural, and political relations with Latin America. On the economic side, there are the Hull Treaties. The United States has developed its ships and its airways leading down to Latin America. On the cultural side, we have a new division in the State Department that looks after that end of it. Better radio broadcasts, student exchange, and so on. And on the political side, we have the emphasis on democracy as the common ideal of all the nations in the New World. And we have our missions, such as the military mission in Brazil. We have the flying fortresses going down to Argentina. We have the sending of a strong delegation to Lima, Peru, for the new Pan-American Conference. We're not ready yet in the New World for an American League of Nations, but we are marching in that direction. And no one who has studied, as I have on the spot, the fascist penetration of Latin America can fail to believe that we must bend every effort in order to strengthen there the democratic currents and to unite with every other country in opposing those fascist currents which are already washing very definitely against the shores of the New World. Good night.
Headlines and bylines. Gilbert Seldes, pioneer critic of the popular arts.
Sometimes events in this part of Headlines and Bylines are precise parallels to the great events in international politics. Sometimes they're altogether a sharp contrast, as they are tonight. Such a case as tonight, you wonder whether anyone in any other country can have quite as much fun as we have. This week, two lines of Shakespeare were left in a musical show which charmed New York. Ferdinand the Bull appeared in a movie which apparently is charming the country. From abroad, an American, Gertrude Stein, announced that she is doing a new version of Faust. The movies came out of a rather dull spell. Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion is promised soon on the screen, so there ought to be a good winter. And to protest against uprooting some of Washington's cherry trees, some women sang the song Trees to the White House, probably the most famous and, in my own opinion, the worst song ever written on the subject. But I think that of all the events of the week, the most interesting to everybody would be the biography of Calvin Coolidge, written by William Allen White. The small-town lawyer who became president is analyzed by the small-town editor who became a great national figure by staying 40 years on Main Street. The book is called A Puritan in Babylon. A few months ago, I was in Kansas to work out a radio program with Mr. White and his Emporia Gazette, and Mr. White made a proposal to me. In effect, he said, look here, no one really knows what constitutes libel or slander, so why don't we try to find out? I'm going to publish this biography of Coolidge. You'll review it on the air and call it all the bad names you can think of. Then I'll sue you for damages, and after the case gets to the Supreme Court, and you and I are both dead, the law of libel will be clear and established. He even went so far as to suggest certain particular insults. The only thing he didn't offer to do was to pay the lawyer's fees. Well, I'm afraid the test case will have to wait because I haven't anything actionable to say about A Puritan in Babylon. To write a biography of Calvin Coolidge is a hard job in itself. This one, in addition, is a biography of the American people during some of the happiest and most foolish years of their lives. You can feel that Mr. White liked Calvin Coolidge, but you can also feel that he didn't like the Coolidge politics and economics. Coolidge was never sympathetic to the progressivism of Theodore Roosevelt, and that automatically means that William Allen White must be a little unsympathetic to Coolidge. Once a newspaper said that Mr. White had been a liberal all his life. That's silly, said Mr. White. I began as a black reactionary. That was a slight exaggeration. Then I'll tell you what happened, said Mr. White. I was bitten by Theodore Roosevelt, and I've never recovered. This progressivism is the background against which Coolidge is measured in Mr. White's book. One of the most interesting portions of the book deals with Coolidge's bewilderment and distress when the Depression came. About that, I can contribute one small item on fairly good authority. Coolidge, you remember, was asked to write a daily comment for a newspaper syndicate, and he went to some of his best-informed friends in financial and industrial circles. He told him he didn't want to write a daily piece for the papers if the Depression was going to last. He knew that some people blamed him for his policy of inaction. He felt it'd be embarrassing to protest or to justify himself. And his well-informed friends assured him that the Depression would be over in 6 months and he could take the job. I think that was about 1931. So it's not remarkable that one of the last comments Coolidge ever did write reflected a little bit on his advisors. He said, "The condition of the country is not good." And that was a typical remark. Well, Mr. White is not going to sue me for saying that his book recreates the whole feel and atmosphere of the 1920s. He told me to say that his reputation has not been improved by this book, but I can't say that. I say instead that his reputation needs no improvement. And this book is the concentrated essence of all that William Allen White has thought and felt about America, and no man has thought more sensibly or felt more deeply. But if I keep thinking about William Allen White, which is a pleasant subject, I shall never get to the other items of this report. The Shakespeare item is local just now to New York, but the idea behind it may spread. The crafty producer, George Abbott, once tried to do Uncle Tom's Cabin in a new version, seriously, as if slavery were still a horror, which it is. That show failed badly. Then Abbott decided he would redo another forgotten masterpiece, Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors, and play it for just as much fun as ever Shakespeare got out of it. He kept the plot about the twin gentlemen with the twin servants, and he kept exactly two totally unimportant lines of the original. When these two lines are spoken, the comedian Jimmy Savile pops suddenly out of the wings and cries out in triumph, "Shakespeare." The rest of the show is rowdy entertainment with attractive songs and Jimmy Savile's inspired clowning. So, the people who have been opening tombs in Westminster Abbey to discover whether Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare may now retire. Obviously, George Abbott wrote Shakespeare and did it better. The fanatics about Ferdinand the Bull are almost as violent as the Shakespeareans. If they have any quarrel, Walt Disney has disarmed them in advance by using the original drawings as models. He's made a start in the direction I hope he'll follow, because then he can go on and do the classic Little Black Sambo and Babar the Elephant, and in the background, there's always Alice in Wonderland. Apparently, we're in one of those periods when people are rediscovering all the classics. About the new version of Faust, which Gertrude Stein is doing, reports are skimpy. But there's available a bit of a lyric addressed to Satan, which runs without punctuation and, of course, without music. And you wanted my soul. What did you want my soul for? How do you know I have a soul? Who says so? Nobody says so. It will sound differently when it's sung. Miss Stein says of the entire work, yes, it's rather amusing. She probably underestimates it, because everything she writes has tremendous power and intelligence behind it, and her operatic work is enchanting to boot. When I mentioned Ferdinand a couple of minutes ago, something ran through my mind about social significance. Didn't seem right. But now I remember that when the book was first issued, some people said that Ferdinand was fascist. Some said he was communist, and some thought that Ferdinand was just an old-fashioned liberal bull. Nowadays, political meanings creep into everything, the way the Oedipus complex used to in around 26. Most musical shows have a political tinge, and one of them is celebrating an anniversary. A year ago, a group of men and women, professional garment workers, put on a musical show, chiefly for their own amusement, and called it after the instruments of their trade, Pins and Needles. It has been running ever since that time. They have a hit, the song of social significance, the satire is keen, and the carriage trade has been buying tickets from the brokers. Try to imagine that running a year in some other countries. About other countries, two little books have appeared this week. You can read both in an hour. This piece is by Thomas Mann and discusses the Pact of Munich with noble indignation. Our Battle by Hendrik Willem van Loon discusses the right answer we should make to the enemies of liberty. And if part of the right answer is education, there's a remarkable book called Windows on the World, written by Kenneth Gould, written so that high school students can understand it. Dorothy Canfield Fisher has given the best description of this book, an intelligent, humane, and civilized survey of modern society. It starts before the World War, and it comes up to the borders of Czechoslovakia. It analyzes the New Deal just as dispassionately as it dissects fascism and communism. Altogether, it's a quite remarkable book, and I'll repeat the name, Windows on the World. About an hour ago, here in New York, an amazing American girl began a recital. Within the next few months, she'll be appearing all over the country, and not for the first time. Her name is Agne Enters. Her recitals are her own combinations of dance and pantomime, entirely unique in the theater and very exciting. She's one of the most solitary workers in the world. She created her own style of presentation. She makes her own costumes. In the old days, she used to address her own circulars. Now she's as much praised for her writing and painting as for this special work of hers, these extraordinary events on the stage, which in the past 10 years, more and more people have come to admire. By this time, her recital is probably finished. And I notice I had better finish too. Good night.
The Columbia Broadcasting System has presented the 62nd program of its Sunday night series, Headlines and Bylines, bringing you the latest reports on the shifting scenes of the world news and headlines in the week's foreign and domestic news with bylines by
Ralph Edwards,
H.V. Kaltenborn,
Gilbert Seldes.
What will next week bring?
Can French government prevent general strike?
Will President announce new policy towards fascist states?
Will Lima Conference promote new world union?
Tune in again next Sunday night at the same time for Headlines and Bylines with Ralph Edwards giving you the last-minute news from Press Radio Bureau.
H.V. Kaltenborn with his keen analysis of national and foreign affairs.
Gilbert Seldes, critic of the popular and fine arts, interpreting their significance in the news of the day.
Headlines and Bylines is another weekly feature of Columbia's extensive news coverage. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.